This interview with Phil Rizzuto took place on June 12, 1993, at Milwaukee County Stadium. The interviewer is Larry Baldassaro. Phil Rizzuto, June 12, 1993. And why don't we start by talking a little bit about your family background, where your folks came from and when they came to the States.
Well, naturally, they're from Italy and from the a little place called Calabria, and the province was Cosenza, and all my relatives on both my mother and father's side came from there. And then when they did migrate to the United States, it was amazing. They all moved in these like three family houses, but they were connected to each other, and it was and with a little alleyway and a backyard, and everybody would come out. Oh, it was one of the greatest times of my life, because they all played musical instruments, the mandolin, and they sing, and then they tell stories in Italian, and they make wine, and that was, as long as there was food on the table, everybody was happy.
Now they came to New York?
Yes, they came to New York, yes.
Do you know when they came over?
Well, let's see. I was born in 1917, and I had two sisters older than myself. All of us were born here, so they came over. It had to be, I should know the exact date, but I just never thought of it, about when they came over. It was, it had to be 1912, because my sisters are both older than myself. I'm my one older sister, then the next one, then me. I was the third in line, so couldn't have been more than a year or two at the most apart. So if I was born in 1917, say 5 years, 1912, it'd be pretty safe to say right around there.
Mm-hmm. Do you know why they came to New York? Were there other family members already
there?
Well,
because there were family members there, but also because the rest of them all came together. They had gotten together over there and decided to come over, and was a lot better then, even though it was tough then, than it is now. When you see these things happening to people, like that boat that capsized, that with all the Chinese on it.
Right.
You know, I understand, to deviate just a little bit, you don't have to use this, but they have people that go to these different countries now, and they try to sell the natives of the country they go to on the idea that everybody in America has two cars and two television sets, and they make it sound, you know, like the old days, said the streets are paved with gold, and then they get them here and they put them in those sweatshops, and it's terrible, really terrible. My relatives happen to be a lot luckier than that. They were able to come here and do what they knew how to do.
What did laboring. Your dad do when he first came?
They were laborers. They built homes, they built garages, they built sidewalks, they built...
In New York City.
In New York City, and out in Long Island, and all around. And then my father was very fortunate somehow. One of the men he met, I don't know how it happened. I was still going to school, high school at the time, and he got a job as a motorman on a trolley car. And my mother was so happy because he didn't have to travel all these distant places and stay away for a lot of nights, you know, when they were building something. Because if you built like 20 miles away, it would take you four or five hours to get there. They didn't have the highways that they have now.
Right.
So she was very happy. And he had that for until the trolley cars went out of, became extinct. I think that's the biggest mistake all these cities made, was taking up the trolley cars, the tracks. way to get around now, they could really use him with all the cars and all the traffic. And then he ended up working down the docks, not as a longshoreman, but as sort of security and, I wouldn't call him a watchman, but anyway, it was not a, it's a job that he, at his age, was just perfect for him.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people to talk to, and of course the ships that went to Italy and came back, he would help be one of the interpreters when they ever needed him.
What are some of your earliest childhood memories?
Well, the ones I told you about in the backyard, but I wouldn't miss one of those evenings where they would sing. And in those days, it was fairly easy to pick up the Italian language, because everybody talked Italian when they first came over. And until, maybe if they'd been here about 10 years. And, you picked up so much that way. And, never any arguments, always singing, talking. And the kids, my cousins, we had a lot of them. Right on the street, in those days, we used to play right on the street all the games you could think of. Touch football, punch ball, now this is a game that a lot of people don't know about out in the Midwest and places.
Yeah.
And then box ball was another one, where you'd get the four corners and guy'd pitch with English on it and you'd slap grounders, and triangle ball, you needed less space. I mean, any kind of game. We used to play a game with a tennis racket and a tennis ball, and you had to keep it within the streets. You could hit it as high and far as you wanted, or hit those hard skip grounders. And I tell you, it was great. It was the greatest experience, the hand and eye coordination of all those games you played. And then my mother, to keep from breaking windows, she would get a cover of an old baseball that our baseballs would wear out in the streets. And they didn't have many baseball fields then around, and she'd take and stuff it with rags and then sew it back up again, and we played with that, and you could throw curves and throw, and just all those things you never realized, but I'm sure they helped me in my hand-eye coordination and helped me do as well as I did when I was a kid and later on.
Was your first language Italian?
No, I spoke English because my mother and father spoke English.
They had
learned English, and they wanted me. They spoke English in the house all the time.
But so they were encouraging you to speak English.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
They wanted you to become American.
Yes, the it's changed a lot now. You know, a lot of the people now that come over from the other side, whether they be Italian or German or Chinese, they want their children to learn their language first. And then they know when they go to school they're going to learn English, so they have two languages. This way, if they learn to speak English right away, they'll forget their language.
Yeah.
And they want them to keep that, which I think is pretty smart.
So your folks were encouraging you to speak English. Did you sense that they felt it was better to be American, to become American, or did
they retained their heritage. They wanted to retain their heritage, but they knew that in school it would be difficult for me. If I wanted something and I just spoke Italian mostly, just a few words in English, and it worked out for the best, because they still kept, with all the relatives right there living together, they still got their Italian in more than enough.
So you picked up some of the Italian just from being around the relatives?
Yeah, I picked up a lot. But then when I moved and got married, I didn't move from that section until I got married. And then when I went to New Jersey, I lost that daily communication. And it's amazing how soon you can forget.
Well, when you were a kid, did you ever have a sense that there was something embarrassing or wrong about being Italian?
No way. I remember, even though my father used to tell me stories, and this is way back then, about the Black Hand.
Mm-hmm.
And They never called the mafia in those days. It might have been in Sicily, where supposedly it all started, but, you know, everybody says there's no such thing as the mafia. But anyway, but the Black Hand was similar to that, because they were very influential and big. They had to do it, and if they ever painted a Black Hand or put a hand there and made it a Black Hand, you were gone. Kind of scary. I know my father did that just to scare me to stay on the straight and narrow.
Mm-hmm. But you had the sense that your folks were proud to be Italian.
Oh, yes. And they also, in those days, a pool hall was not as elegant as it is now. You know,
yeah.
Now the women go in their plush, but then it was like not a den of iniquity either, but it was a place that was smoky and people drank there, and he knew we liked to shoot pool, my brother and I, and he bought us a pool table, a regulation size pool table, and put it down in the basement. And then we had kids across the street who did the same thing, their parents, and they were German, and then we had an Irish family. That whole block happened. I was so lucky. They all played sports, all different sports.
But it wasn't
touch football
exclusively in Italian.
Oh no. Our little area, our little niche, was all Italian. And then across the street, they had prevalent Germans, and then the Irish upstairs. Oh. It was just a great mixture then of
this was in
nationalities.
Brooklyn.
Yeah.
In Brooklyn.
Yeah. Oh, great mixture.
You remember what part of Brooklyn?
Ridgewood, the Ridgewood section of Brooklyn.
And these ethnic groups, German, Irish, Italian, got along well?
Oh, very well.
Yeah, right.
Very well. All the parents and all the kids, but it wasn't like socializing. It was just that if you ran into one in the barber shop or the butcher shop. And
as far as socializing, you had your extended family, I assume.
Oh yeah,
a lot of cousins and so on.
Oh yes, so loaded and there were so many they all couldn't fit in that one little establishment place that we had, and the rest were scattered around in areas maybe half a mile away, and
they're all pretty close,
pretty
together.
Bunched up. Yeah.
As you look back, did you think that you were deprived economically, or
never gave it a thought? Mm-hmm. I mean, we never asked for or wanted things like the kids today. You know, they get it so easily. But I mean, like I said, it was always food on the table, and we were out playing ball every day, whether. In the baseball season, we play baseball, and in the football season, we play football, and in between, we play all those games on the street, and ring a Livio and steal a white flag and kick the can, all those games the kids, I don't know whether they know about them, but boy, we never sat still. And then we'd come in and eat and go out and play, and you could play box ball and triangle ball under the street lights, right on that four corners.
Mm-hmm.
That made it great. So it was always activity. And we formed teams, and we'd have to fight, not fight, but get up early to get to the ball, to a field like they had three or four fields where you need a permit to play on. The first one's there, had to play on it. But you didn't think anything of it, you know. It was just great getting out there. We never had uniforms when we were kids. But we'd beat a lot of teams that had uniforms.
So you were playing hardball.
Oh,
from
yeah.
An early age, not just very in the streets.
No, very early age. And as a matter of fact, I would get frustrated quite often, because in those days, the way they picked teams to play, they have two captains, and then they'd flip a coin, whoever won, he'd have the first pick from all of us standing around. I'll take him. And more than 50% of the time, nobody would pick me, you know, because I was so small. And I'd have to wait. And if somebody had to leave or something, I'd get to play an inning or two. And then gradually, you know, they saw that I could really, you know, I could play, I could do things that they didn't think I could do.
These were kids pretty much your own age?
Yeah, they were my own age, but they were all bigger than myself, which is natural.
did they put you in right field?
They tried to put me in right field, but I always wanted to be an infielder for some reason. But I did play the outfield a lot. matter of fact, an awful lot now that you
bring
that up.
The last kid picked was the
right fielder.
They figured
nobody can hit out. You don't get that many hit out there.
So you started playing just pickup games.
Yeah.
When did you start playing in a more organized sense?
When I went to high school. I tried out for the team, and I made the team, Richmond Hill High School.
Richmond?
Richmond, yeah. Richmond.
Still in Brooklyn, obviously.
No, that was not in Brooklyn. That was across the line, because my father had the trolley car then.
Uh-huh.
And because he had the trolley car, I was able to get free rides to the school, which was like about a mile and a half from the house. And we were allowed to go there because the other schools were crowded in the Brooklyn section we lived in. And it was in a place called, Richmond Hill was the name of the area, too. And there was a big park there, Forest Park, which was a beautiful park. They had a golf course, and they had baseball fields and football fields. And it was like the parade grounds, which is a big place in Brooklyn, where they have all these, now like Central Park is.
Uh-huh.
So that was my first sense of organized ball in high school. And then in the summers, we had a club like the Wayne Athletic Club, we called it. We had chipped in, we bought uniforms, and we would play other teams with uniforms. We played, not supposed to, but we played for like $5 a man a game, and we'd pass the hat on, you know, get money that way. And it was pretty good, it was really pretty good ball. And then it progressed each year. One of the great stories is we won our division championship, and we played the championship game for the PSAL championship at Ebbets Field. And what a thrill that was. Oh, my gosh. And I'll never forget, my high school coach was a little guy, too. And later on, I tell you, he was the one that got me started in thinking about a professional career, because he tried to become one. But in that game, that was my first, I was a freshman then.
And freshman, he said, look, in high school?
In high school. And he said, I don't want you to swing at any pitches. I mean, I wasn't even 5 foot tall then. Not quite 5 feet tall. And sure enough, I walked, and I could run like hell. I'd steal second, I'd steal third, and that's why he said, don't swing. And it was like tie score, and the next to last inning, I'm coming up to bat, and somehow the guy got two quick strikes at me. So I knew I had a swing, and the next pitch I swung and fouled it, and it hit the umpire right in the Adam's apple, and he almost died. I mean, it was scary. And I figured, well, maybe that's why he doesn't want me to swing at the ball, but that was awful. And we ended up winning the game. And then I grew a couple inches, and I was playing on these teams on the side. And then just before my last year of high school, I got to play with a semi-pro team. And, I mean, that was better than any minor league experience I had. I batted against Satchel Paige, the House of David, the Black Yankees, all those guys, a lot of them in the Hall of Fame. I mean, they were, I mean, and don't forget, we played under portable lights in our day. Now, portable lights are like in here, trying to hit off Satchel Paige, who was in his prime then. This is 1936 and 1937. No, not 37, 36 and 35. And these guys sometimes would play three games a day because they went by bus. But what? I mean, Great Danes, the House of David, the Black Yankees, the Royal Giants,
wow.
Homestead Grays. Oh, geez.
That's amazing. And you were still in high school.
I was still in, which I had to play under an assumed name, but I would forfeit all those games.
This
I used an Irish name to make sure that they...
No kidding. You remember what you used?
Yeah, I used Kennedy.
Kennedy?
Never knowing that later on, but I had it because that would have been a terrible thing.
That's funny.
If they found out. But I got, I was some experience, and it helped me get through the minor leagues the first couple of years, too. Because I knew the fundamentals of the game. These guys were new. Oh boy, we watched
some real competition, yeah.
They knew how to play the game. And so many of them could have been in the big leagues, but because of the color line, you know. The Cuban All-Stars, they had a great team, too. Casa David was arrived with the beards.
Right. So then did you sign right out of high school?
Yeah, but I had a lot of tryouts first.
Then the Red Sox?
The first team I tried out was the Dodgers, and that's when they had the problems with Casey. Casey was managing. That was in 1937. I had just graduated from. Rather, it was 1936. Of course, in 37 was my first year. I went away. The Yankees signed me, but in 36 we had these tryouts at Ebbets Field. It was not a tryout like they have today. They line you up and you run from the right field foul line to the left field foul line. The first 50 they keep, and I was so fast, I was always one of the first 50. Then you get 5 swings and go out and field your position. And this kid that was trying to impress Casey, you know, who was there at the workout, he hit me right in the middle of the back with the first pitch. Mm. I stiffened up and I couldn't hit. And never forget, Casey said, "All right, kid, listen, you go out and get a shoe shine box. That's the only way you're going to make a living. You'll never make it in the big league."
Oh.
Then about a week later, my coach, high school coach, got me a tryout with the Giants. Bill Terry was the manager.
Mm-hmm.
Another Hall of Famer. And he didn't even let me work out. He just said, "I'll let you stay and watch the game today, but we're looking for guys who can hit home runs." Because there were only 8 teams in each league, and everybody wanted to be a big league ball player.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Red Sox. And they were going to sign me. But it was a very unusual thing, because they said they were looking at another kid. Because at this time I'm playing shortstop. I had played shortstop all through high school, and but with the Wayne AC and them, I caught. I used to catch a lot of times without a mask. We didn't have a mask. I'd look in and I didn't foul tip and hit me in the nose of the head. And I play outfield and shortstop, third base. But then in high school he put me at shortstop and I stayed there. And the Red Sox had just signed, they said, "This kid lives in Louisville, he looks like a great," and it was Pee Wee Reese.
Yeah.
So it turned out, and I wanted to play for the Red Sox. I heard about a short left field fence, you know, and all that. And so anyway, you see, so Pee Wee played with, and then I played against Pee Wee, and I was with Kansas City, he was with Louisville. That was a Red Sox farm team. But then the Dodgers bought him from Louisville, and so he became a Dodger. So eventually I might have gone to the Red Sox, but who knows. But
so you mean initially you would have preferred to be a Red Sox than a Yankee?
Well, I never thought I'd get, whoever thought that you could get with the Yankees, with Neil, you'd read about that.
Oh,
dynasty, geez.
Yeah.
But then the Yankees they were the last ones, and they had this unusual tryout. For a full week, every day you went to the ballpark, and every day you played a game, and different situations would come up. They'd ask you to bunt, they'd ask you to hit and run, try to steal. And you'd play third, you'd play second, you'd play short. And I happened to have a great week. I couldn't do anything wrong. So they called me in, and they wanted to send me to Butler, Pennsylvania, which was the Yankee farm team. D League, they had D League now. They don't have anything like that now. And they wanted to give me $70 a month, which would have been great in that time. That was a lot of money then. And I said, I was working in Bush Terminal, factory work, you know, and I was getting $15 a week. So that was $75. No, it wasn't $15, it's $60. But I was home, you know.
Right.
So I had to go away. So he said, "All right, look, we got another team in Bassett, Virginia. That's Bassett. and they play a month longer, and we'll give you $75 a month. Great. Now, I had never been away from home. And I'll never forget when I had to leave to go there. Like, we had a couple of weeks of spring training, but you trained right in the town where you, because it was down south anyway. My father would, I told him, read all these things about the Black Ink. Took a 20, because he didn't give me any money, no bonuses or anything. He pinned a $20 bill to my undershirt. Don't let anybody, they send you in a train, but it, I'll never forget how beautiful, you know, riding through Washington and Richmond. We stopped at Richmond, and I had my first taste of Southern fried chicken. Oh, gee. And grits and all that. Yeah. So then we got to Bassett. And now don't forget, I had never been away from home. And I get off the train, and there's nothing there. I said, where the hell is the town? I mean, I had a little valise, an old, you know, cardboard valise it was practically. And my glove and my spikes, and then the train pulled away, and there was the town. There was a drugstore, a post office, and lunch, and a diner.
Mm-hmm.
That was the whole town. They had a movie theater, which was open, I think, 1 or 2 days a week. Oh, I couldn't believe it. And they only had like 1,300 people in the whole town. And it was very hilly. Oh, God, it was really hilly. And they used to say, yeah, this is a very unusual place. All the cows have, the front legs are shorter than their back legs, so that they can climb. And I believe, you know, I believed anything they told me. I believed.
The city boy.
Okay, and they... you know, the people were so nice, but I couldn't understand. They couldn't understand me, my Brooklyn accent. I couldn't understand them with their Southern accent.
Just going back just a second, what did you folks think about the idea of you wanting to play
professional ball? My mother was all for it, but my father was dead against it. He wanted me to get a job. You know, fathers were following his footsteps. You can't play baseball. You can't make a living playing baseball. But he didn't hold me back, you know, because he knew my mother really wanted me to go.
Why do you think she was...
I don't know. She was a little more... she read a lot more than my father, because my father had to work hard and he didn't have too much time for him.
Yeah.
She read a lot and she kind of knew what was going on and what give the kids a chance to get away and be on their own and see what they can do.
When did you first start thinking you wanted to do this?
I always wanted to be a ball. Are you kidding? I was like the kids today who... collect cards, only they didn't have cards then. I mean, I read every line score and every game, and I used to make little crystal sets, and you'd be able to get, some of them, there were not many games with broadcast on radio, but the ones that were, I even got games from up in Boston one time. That's how I knew, I knew the wall in Fenway was short, because I'd hear, there's a line drive off the left field wall, and it's a single. I said, now how could it? That guy can't run or something. And then one of the announcers explained just how far it was, and the kind of fence it was, short but high. And I always wanted to be a ball player. And actually, I wake up in a cold sweat sometimes thinking, had I not been a ball player, what would I have been?
Mm-hmm.
I was not one of the smart kids in school, because I didn't, I'm always thinking, oh boy, when we get out of school, I'll play ball. You know, and I just enough to get, you had to pass all your subjects to be eligible to play on the team, and I'd do that, but I'd pass with 65. I got a 70, it was all, and 65 was passing. And I'd just do enough to, which was bad, but like
did,
I said.
Did you want to be a Yankee when you were a kid?
I was a Dodger fan. You kidding? Born in Brooklyn, you had to be a Dodger fan.
Oh,
yeah, the Yankees were the furthest thing from my mind. Oh,
And were there any ball players that, like what we call today role models, that you idolized in those days?
Yeah. It's strange. I idolized more people on the Yankees only because they were more well-known and they were winning at that time, and the Dodgers were not. Dodgers hadn't won in so long. And, I mean, you know, the name Frank Crosetti right away stuck with me. Joe DiMaggio. Well, naturally, Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. I mean, my uncle used to take me. See, my uncle was really good to me. He used to take me to see those great ball players. I saw Ruth and Gehrig and Dickey and Red Ruffing and all those guys way back. And then he'd take me to the Polo Grounds. I saw the Giants with Bill Terry and Dick Bartell and all those great players. And then he took me to Ebbets Field to see the Dodgers. And they had some outstanding players, you know, Glenn Wright. They had for a while. They got him from Pittsburgh, the great shortstop. Al Lopez caught for them. Van Lingle Mungo was one of their pitchers, a great pitcher. And I got to, you know, see these guys, and then I'd read about them, and it made it a lot more interesting.
Well, so now your rookie year is 41.
41.
You come up to the Yankees, and of course, 41 is one of the great years
of
baseball history.
Oh, my gosh. What was everything. That like? Jeez, it was unbelievable. You know, with DiMaggio hitting 56 straight games and Williams hitting over 400.
Yeah.
And that's when I saw my first real live president. We opened in Washington. The Yankees used to always open in Washington. And the history of it, and was that the president would throw out the first ball.
Right.
And every year, whoever was president, was and it was a ritual. I mean, and DiMaggio told me, I said, now look, don't get too close because you'll be. People get spiked, you know, they die for that souvenir. The president throws the ball out. They had to help Roosevelt stand up, you know, and he threw the ball, and everybody dies for it, these monsters. I mean, I didn't come close to it, but I tried. And just to see the president, I never thought I'd ever see a live president. Plus the fact that I had played in Norfolk, Virginia. It was the Piedmont League, when my second year in professional ball. I was 18, and the whole contingent from Norfolk came, because I met wonderful friends there, Italian friends. Matter of fact, the barber from Norfolk, I lived in his home. You know, you lived in boarding,
right.
What they called boarding houses. They
right.
weren't boarding houses, but you lived there and you'd pay them rent and you'd feed them. And he was my best man at the wedding when I got married. That's
Jeez.
How we go back. I'd go back to Norfolk. And they came up with the contingent. Jerry Pretty was with the Yankees, too, and he had played with me at Norfolk, and they gave us gifts, you know. And here it's opening day, and at home plate, they're giving us gifts to rookies.
This was
41.
Norfolk was a triple A?
No, a B.
So you jumped from B?
No, but I had played there.
Okay, so your
played.
First
Bassett
year
was
in
D-A.
Bassett, right.
Then Norfolk. I skipped C. I went from D to B. Then I skipped A and double A and went to triple A to Kansas City.
KC. Okay.
And then I played 2 years there and then came to the. I played 4 years in the minors. But they all came up, you know, because I had made so many friends down there. And that was a big thrill.
So do you remember your first time at the plate?
Oh, I was so near. Dutch Lender was pitching. And I know he was great knuckleball pitcher. Got to know real well, but later on, but because in those days you played each team maybe 20 times, you know, there were just 8 teams in the league,
right.
And you had to play 154 games. But he threw me a knuckleball, and I had made up my mind I was going to swing no matter where, and I could swear I hit it on one bounce and grounded out, and I was my knees were shaking. Dickey had warned me. He said, "Listen," he said, "this, you know, right now you might feel relaxed." He said, "But." You're going to have butterflies, but if you don't have butterflies, you're not a good ball player. He had told me that more than once. Then during the World Series, he said the same thing. He said, as soon as that's over and you get your first chance in the field, first time at bat, it'll go away. And sure enough, it did.
How did the veterans treat you as a rookie?
At that time, it was all right. But prior to that, in spring training, I got a rough time because Crosetti was one of their big favorites and a great guy. And there I was coming, a fresh rookie coming up trying to take his job, and he was so well liked by the players. And but yet, if it hadn't been for Crosetti, I would have looked like a bum in that series, because the Washington Senators had three left-hand hitters who I didn't know where they hit, and he said, "Now look," he said, "you watch me in the dugout." He said, "I'll move you," and he moved me towards third base, and I'd say, "What is he trying to make me look bad?" And every one of them hit towards left field. They were not pull hitters. Yeah, he made me look great. I said, "Geez, what a good." And since then, we became great buddies. I said, "Here's a guy whose job I'm trying to take."
You took his job.
Yeah. And
you won the starting job in spring training.
Yeah.
How old was Crosetti at the time?
Wasn't that old. Oh. He wasn't that old. He came up in 33, and this was 41.
Yeah.
So it was only 8 years later, you know. But he hadn't hit. He had a bad year hitting that time. Finished 100 and something. But and then he did that in every team we played. He would, you know, I didn't know the guys. I didn't know. He knew them like, you know, had a book on them. And he positioned me, and I got to know them. But I still see the Crow every time we go out to the West Coast, and I write to him and call him on the phone once in a while.
What about your first appearance at Yankee Stadium when the folks
there? That was even more nervous. And I didn't get a hit that time either. I was very nervous.
Your dad must have been...
he was proud.
His mind
he, was
now, right?
He was telling everybody that he taught me how to play ball. So, yeah, it was great. Yeah. That year was a phenomenal year. I think we clinched the pennant by the 4th of July. I think we won like by 16 or 17 games.
I mean, here you are, a rookie, and you're on this one of the great teams.
Oh, yeah, that was a great team. Henrik Kellen, DiMaggio in the outfield, Dickey catching, and Ralph and Gordon, and the pitching staff. What names, old. We had so many great pitchers, nobody won more than 15 games. They'd only pitch once a week. All
And you had a good year. You hit, what, 307?
Yeah, 307, yeah.
Year.
And so then I fit in. Then they took me in as one of the members. Charlie Kellogg, he just passed away last year. It was a shame.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't trade it for all the money in the world. I'm just great memories.
And you went into the service 43 through 45, like so many others.
Yeah, 3 years I lost. Yeah.
And then you came back, and the team pretty much picked up.
Not the first year.
Well, the 46. Red Sox won the 46 pennant.
That's it. Everybody thought. None of us thought we'd ever get it back again. You're not used to seeing the fastballs and the curves and. As a matter of fact, there's a great story. It'd take too long to tell you, but that's when they were started trying to get the Mexican League started.
Oh, yeah.
And Sternweiss and I were two ones instrumental in almost breaking up their raid on the American players. They came to George and I, and they had big Cadillac they drove up, in the Pasquale brothers. They had guns in a holster, and we pulled under the bridge by Yankee Stadium under the elevator train, and they whip out $10,000 a piece they wanted to give us. They said, "You come to Mexico with us, come right now," they said, "and call Joe McCarthy from Mexico." And I said, "I can't, can't do that." So they said, "Well, we want to get your wives," which played all day ball, and he said, "Get your wives," and they were staying at the Waldorf Astoria. Oh, never thought we'd ever get to the Waldorf Astoria. So George and his wife and my wife and I, we went, after we got home, we got them, drove in. He lived near me in Jersey then. And we drove into New York, met them at the Waldorf Astoria, and they wined and dined us. And of course, in those days, right after the war, you couldn't get a car, you couldn't get ties. The girls couldn't get nylons or couldn't get butter. You couldn't get anything. They had everything. They were going to set us up with an apartment building. It all turned sour. And I was ready to go. And so was George. I mean, we were both because they wanted to give us more money than what the Yankees were giving us, plus the apartment rent. But then the thing that, the only way we were lucky was they still wanted us to go and not tell McCarthy. And neither one of us could do it. And with unbeknownst to us and to them, they had that room bug, their room, when we went upstairs to talk about it, and they had the contract out of it. So we didn't sign, luckily we didn't sign it, but we talked, and then they heard that, and they got an injunction against the Pasquales. They couldn't leave the country until they appeared before, so they just slipped out of the, quietly, and we, George and I were suspended by Larry McPhail, who owned the club at that time. He got it from, who did he get it from?
Jacob Rupert?
No, Del Webb and Dan Topping. No, he didn't get it from Webb and Topping. Webb and Topping got it from him.
He came later.
McPhail.
Jacob Rupert in there?
I guess it was from the Rupert family, yeah, because this was after the war. Rupert had it my first 2 years, and then when I got into service, I kind of lost it. But then McPhail had it in 46, yeah. And he suspended George and I because we didn't want to appear as a witness against Pazzo. We told him, he said, he's trying to give us, you know, the money. Well, I had gone to war, and they froze my salary. They were giving me what they gave me in 42. The Pasquales left, and they rescinded and put us back on the active list. And matter of fact, gave us a little bit of a raise.
So now, did you get married before you started playing pro ball?
No, I got married. No, I was I got married while I was in the service. I married my wife in 1943. I played 41 and 42. And then got married in 43 while I was in Norfolk, Virginia, going through boot camp.
Where did you meet your wife?
I met her through Joe DiMaggio. Joe was supposed to go to a communion breakfast, and my wife's father was the chairman of that. Well, I didn't know. I had never been in Newark before. And that day, Joe's baby was born, his only child, his boy. And he called me up and says, I got to go to the hospital. You know, my first child, he said, I got to be there. I said, yes, go. He said, you got to fill in for me. I said, oh, here's a guy. In Newark, he was idolized. They had a big Italian population. And he used to tell me about it. They gave him diamond rings. And he says, you got to fill in for me because, and I said, oh, Joe, they'll shoot me. They'll run me out of town. So he was hitting 56 straight again. He was the most valuable player in the American League. And I'm a rookie, and you know, and they didn't know who I was, and sure enough, I got over there, and oh, man, cold, icy silence. I was, holy God.
So this was in 41?
In 41. In, I guess it was November of 41, or the end of October. And I had never given a speech before, you know, I was lousy as that, but oh, then no applause, and I mean, some of them actually booed when they announced that because it happened on that day and there was no time for them to get, you know, everybody expecting to see DiMaggio and I wore. Why? But anyway, then he, my father-in-law, who came later, became my father-in-law, saw how uncomfortable I was. He said, come on, he said, take you home, get you a cup of coffee and then you relax. I said, it's a shame. It was so... See, DiMaggio knew my wife's family because my wife's sister used to go with a friend of DiMaggio's. Okay. And so he'd go over there and eat once in a while.
They were Italian?
Yeah, they were Italian, yeah. No, not my wife. No. But
no.
The one that her sister went with was
okay.
Italian. And he was like Joe's, would take Joe every place, drive him places and make arrangements for him for everything. While I was there having a cup of coffee, I saw this vision come down the stairs. And I, you know how they say in the movies, love at first sight? It was unbelievable. Oh. I had never gone with a girl. I'd never dated a girl.
Is that right?
And holy cow, I was struck.
That's a great story.
I'd come over every night and I'd take her out to dinner and I asked her to marry me after it was, don't forget, this is 41. So it was in November. Yeah, it was in November because towards the end of November, as a matter of fact. Because I guess in America, after I had Winder and Diner in the early part of November, I stayed over there and went back and forth, driving back and forth from Brooklyn to Newark. And I asked her to marry me, and she said no. Just like that. I mean, I'd taken this beautiful restaurant they were playing, Impossible by Perry Como's, and I got so mad. I got in my car and drove to Norfolk, Virginia to see these people, who I knew so well, and because I used to go down there after each year anyway.
The barber.
And I'm down there, and December came, and if you know what happened December 7th, right? Mm-hmm. I get a call from my mother. She knew I was down there because I called and told her where I was. And my Lefty Gomez had called my mother, and he was really a great guy and kidded everybody. He had told my mother, where's Phil? And she said, oh, he's down in Norfolk, Virginia. And he said, well, you better get him back. He said, the Japs are right outside the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And my mother believed him. She called me up, get home, as if I could do anything. But anyway, I came home, and I called her, and we went out again. And in January, I asked her again. She said no. So then February, I went to spring training. Came back, the season started, I came back. This is 42 now. And I didn't see her for a while, because it was pretty tough playing, doing that traveling.
Mm-hmm.
And then about the middle of the year, I asked her again, and she still said, three times I asked her. I said, all this time she had been taking, her family were Protestant, you know, and she was taking Catholic instructions,
oh, okay.
And she became a convert. And when she finally became a convert, it unfortunately was after I had gone in the Navy, when the World Series was over in 42, I went right in the Navy. And one day, I couldn't believe it, one day after boot camp, when I was allowed out, you know, you got to stay in boot camp for, I don't know how many weeks up here, where they cut your hair all off, and they give you a couple of days to go home, and I called her, and I didn't get to see her because I didn't have enough time to go over there. And she said, well, I'll get in touch with you down there. And sure enough, one day she came down, and she had made arrangements with the... I told her about this Italian family that I stayed with some time or other. Son of a gun, if they didn't take her in, this one day she called me, because we had to stay right at the Norfolk Naval Training Station, right in the barracks there. And she came with this barber, and they picked me up, and he took me back to the house. She said, well, if you still want me. And sure enough, we got married while she was down there. And the sailor assumed we had a one-day honeymoon because the war was on. They didn't want to give me that.
Yeah.
And then, unfortunately, until we were married in June, and in March of the next year, just 3 days after our first child was born, we got orders, all athletes shipped overseas. And I was gone. So I missed all of 43, 44, and 45.
Mm-hmm.
But I was lucky, I came back. You know, a lot of guys didn't come back.
Yeah.
And I ended up in New Guinea and the Philippines. And
so you were one of those that actually saw action.
Yeah, but... you know, the Navy was a lot better than the Army, I guess that's what... unless you had that run to Murmansk or whatever it was. There. Remember when they were torpedoing all those ships?
Well, getting back to the baseball then, 49, you were runner-up to Ted Williams as MVP.
Yeah.
In 50, you won it.
Yeah, 50, I won. I couldn't believe it. In 49, I just missed, and I had no idea. And in 50, I never thought I'd get. You know, with guys like DiMaggio and Williams, Yogi was having his great years then.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Then you played in 9 World Series.
Yeah.
What, 5 All-Star games?
So yeah. Yeah, I was very lucky, very lucky.
What did it mean to you, or in looking back, to be a Yankee?
When you got to be a Yankee, when you first, in those days, now it's not that way now, but the pinstripes and the NY meant so much then. I mean, it was something to live up to and live for, and once you got in the habit of winning, that's one reason they won so many times. A lot of clubs never experience the thrill of winning and what it means to win and get in a World Series and win that. I mean, to us, it was almost automatic, and we didn't get in. Because you figure, in my 13 years, only 3 times we didn't get in a World Series. I played in 9 World Series, but the 10th one I would have played in, but that was the year that they released me in the last day of August. 55, yeah. No, 56.
56.
I played in the 55 World Series, which was the only one we lost to Brooklyn.
Yeah.
But then the 56 I would have played, except that Casey said they needed a left-handed hitter. And that's when they got Slaughter, who was older than me. I couldn't believe it.
What was Casey like to play for? I mean, the earlier story about Casey telling you
had to get a shoe-shine box. 2 or 3 years was fine because he just said, listen, I know nothing about the American League, so you guys go out and play. And we would win all the time. And then he had a method. He wanted to get rid of all the veteran ball players. Because he was afraid to talk to DiMaggio, you know, Keller and Henrik and guys, even me. And as 51, DiMaggio left, and then Keller, Henrik, roughing all the guys, you know, and then got all the kids, Mantle, Martin, McDougal, all those young ball players, yeah. And then he became, in my late years, he started the platooning system. He's the one that started the platoon system.
Frank Bauer.
Bauer and Woodling, they wanted to kill him. And yet there was best thing that happened to them for their career, which they found out later on. They lasted longer.
So there really was something to the Yankee mystique.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, every year we'd pick up a Johnny Mize, a Ewell Blackwell, somebody who would, Irv Noren, guys that just you needed for that.
Oh, yeah.
And sure enough, they'd come through, you know.
And what about the Yankee-Red Sox rivalry?
Oh, that was it couldn't have been a better one. I mean, that was really intense. With the players and the fans, you know. When we went up there, they'd have a lot of Yankee fans. Somebody bring that cannolis?
Somebody brought it up.
Cannolis,
for an Italian-American publication, in a sense, a general question would be, both as a baseball player and as a human being, what has it meant to you to know that you are an Italian-American or of Italian background?
Well, I mean, I'm very proud of the fact that I am Italian and what they've accomplished in all the fields of painting and literature and religion and baseball. I mean, one of the reasons I think the Yankees had always been successful whenever they had a lot of Italians on the team. Not that the other guys weren't good, but it just seemed like when they had that little mixture of the Italians and the rest of them in, everything just worked out perfectly. It's and you know, when you go around the country and play in these different cities, and they all have their Italian section, and they all come out to the game, and it's really, I get such a big thrill out of that. They don't care if they are Cleveland fans; they still root for the Yankees because of that, because of the Italian connection, as we put it.
Why do you think there were so many Italians that played baseball in your era, not just for the Yankees?
You know, I tried to figure that out, but I couldn't tell. Like, it's be different if they all lived in a warm climate, you know, because that's where you find most of the ball players coming from, whether it be the West Coast or Texas or Arizona or Miami, Florida. But I don't know just what it is. It's got to have something to do with the heritage, the hard work ethics, and the desire, you know, to be the best you can be. But too many kids got potential, and they don't live up to it. They just do enough to get by, mediocre. And yet if they put it to the test and would bear down all the time, they'd be really great, a lot better than they are.
In that sense, you think that the game has changed since the time you
played?
Oh,
it's changed an awful lot, and I don't think for the better either. And it's not the players' fault as much as the owners and the ones who pay these tremendous salaries. I mean, can't take it away from the ball players. If I were playing now, I'd love to get the money they're getting now.
Sure.
But it's also money first and then the game of baseball second, whereas before it was always baseball first. And then you played to get good money. Now they don't have to do that anymore because they get five-year contracts and they get this feeling of security, which tends to let down your playing and your hustling a lot more than it would be if you had to have a good year every year. Now, if you got a five-year contract, you just have to have a good year the last year of that five-year contract.